Yes, indeed. Everybody's Jumping by Dave Brubeck. It's his birthday today, born 1920. And, birthdays of frogs, they go back millennia, millions of years. And I have Kerry Krieger on the phone here with Save the Frogs. Hi, Kerry.
Hi, Arnold. How's it going?
Well, very good. Thank you. It's good weather for frogs, whatever you're talking about. They love water, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do. Amphibians get their name because they're amphibious, which means they have two lives, one on land and one in water. So, yes, they do love the rain. They have eggs that don't have a hard shell like birds or reptiles' eggs, so that means the eggs always have to stay moist, which is why the amphibians get really active when it rains.
It all works for them at that point, yes. So, Kerry, very interesting. First of all, how did you get into frogs? It's not an obscure subject, but how did you get into it?
Well, I grew up on about 20 acres of land, and we had a pond on the property, so I definitely spent a lot of time when I was young hanging out at the pond and running around outdoors, and I didn't have a specific frog interest, but I certainly got into nature, and I guess in the middle of my college years, I started traveling a lot and hiking and camping out at national parks all around the world once I graduated, and I developed this love of outdoors. So even though I studied engineering in college, I wanted to go back to school and learn all about environmental science and how to protect wildlife and keep our planet looking beautiful. So I somehow woke up one day and frogs were on my mind. I think I perhaps read an article that said frogs were disappearing, and I wanted to do my PhD in environmental science, and I thought it'd be fun to work on streams because I like hanging out at streams when I go hiking. So the thought hit me, hey, frogs live on streams and frogs need help, so how about I do my PhD research on frogs? And I had been backpacking in Australia before that, and I remembered a place called Yungala that had a lot of frogs. So I did some research on the web and found someone who had done frog research in Yungala, and I ended up going to Australia for 4 years to do my PhD research on frogs. And
wow.
I'm still working with frogs to this day.
Beautiful. Look what power they have. They made you cross the globe.
Yes,
change your life.
I've done a lot of traveling to go find frogs, to talk to people about frogs, teach people about frogs. And, yeah, frogs are really amazing animals, and they need a lot of help. So I'm very fortunate to get to work with frogs and help out the frogs.
So when did you start Save the Frogs?
I started Save the Frogs in early 2008. So we're about 5.5 years old, and we're growing, and I certainly hope that some of your listeners out there will go to savethefrogs.com, which is our website, and we've got hundreds of pages about amphibians and ways people can help them and all about the work that we do.
Excellent. And now, this isn't just a localized thing. You work all around the world.
Yeah, that's right. We're based in California. Our office is in Berkeley, and I'll tell you about that soon, because we just moved to Berkeley. But yes, we have a branch in Ghana in West Africa that's really active, and we have groups in Colombia and Mexico and Bangladesh. And then we have lots of volunteers in many, many countries. Our biggest thing that we do is called Save the Frogs Day. And so we have the 6th annual Save the Frogs Day is coming up April 26, 2014. And it's place every year, and basically what we do is provide educational materials and inspiration to people to go out into their communities wherever they are in the world and do something beneficial for frogs, organize some type of activity, maybe habitat restoration, or maybe educating people in their community. Sometimes there have been people who've held protests in the past, such as against restaurants that sell frog legs. One time I held a rally at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in D.C. to call for a federal ban on atrazine, which is a very harmful pesticide. So Save the Frogs Day, we got activity all over the world. Last year we had about 270 events in over 30 countries, which reached about 17,000 people at those events. So we were very happy with that. And our goal is to keep growing Save the Frogs Day each year. So we hope that if there's someone out there listening who really cares about frogs, that they will check out the Save the Frogs Day webpage, get ideas on how they can take part.
Exactly. Now, I mean, I grew up the park across from me and, you know, always had tadpoles and frogs. But maybe nowadays a lot of kids really don't experience them, apart from their rarity now. But I suppose because of urban sprawl, are they not in our environment anymore in that way?
Well, you're definitely right. I talk to people all the time who grew up in a certain area and said that when they were a kid, they'd see frogs all over the place and they'd hear them. And now when they go back, they don't see them, or maybe the pond or the forest is completely gone. I grew up in Northern Virginia, and Northern Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C., the suburbs are definitely expanding. And every time I return to Virginia, I see places that the last time I was there, it was forest, and now it's just some development. So frogs are losing their habitats for certain among many reasons that they're having trouble. So, yeah, a lot of kids these days grow up, and they may never see a frog in the wild. Perhaps they live in a city. Maybe they live in the suburbs. And frogs in particular are not animals that are often seen by humans, because frogs come out usually on nights, and that's when humans go inside.
Right.
And definitely as things get more technological, people spend less time in nature anyway. So, yeah, there's definitely a generation of kids that are growing up a bit disconnected from nature. And so that's a lot of what we do is environmental education to make sure that people care about frogs and know that they're important and know that they're having trouble, and we teach people ways to protect them.
Right. And now, obviously, frogs are all around the world, from, I imagine, the Arctic Circle to the hottest forests on Earth. And it's not just frogs. I mean, we're talking toads and newts in this group, are we?
Yeah. Amphibians are the frogs and toads, the newts and salamanders, and the Sicilians. Sicilians most people don't know about. We don't have them in America, and they're not in Europe. They're in Central and South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia, and they're basically limbless amphibians, and they live underground, so they're also hard to find, and they're hard to research. So there's about 7,000 amphibian species around the world. About 6,000 are frogs and toads, 800 are salamanders and newts, and then there's a couple hundred known Sicilians. And there's probably lots of species out there that we have not discovered yet, and hopefully we will be able to protect frogs by protecting their habitats, among other things, so that they do survive, and maybe one day we will see them out there.
Exactly. And now people always ask, what's the difference between a frog and a toad?
Okay, so technically all toads are frogs, and frog and toad, it's kind of difficult because we give common names, which are inherently confusing, as opposed to scientific names, which are meant to clear things up. But usually the toads that we talk are a family of amphibians called Bufonidae. And these toads usually have large paratoid glands on their back that are filled with toxins, because toads tend to have short legs and be pretty slow. And that's because they don't need to escape predators like a frog would jump erratically. The toad just has lots of toxins on its skin. So that's one of the primary differences. But essentially, frogs and toads are pretty much the same. It's like newts and salamanders are pretty much the same. There's just some slight differences there as well.
Right. Oh, interesting. And now, it's amazing. I was just looking at them and there's actually a huge variation in the size of how they come. There's one was like 9 millimeters long, and then you get those huge cane toads. There's an amazing proportional jump in them.
Yeah, amphibians in general have a huge amount of variety, their size, their color, where they live, the type of habitats they're in. You can look at their feet and tell a lot about them by if they have toe pads. And so, yeah, there's a huge amount of variety. Largest frog is the Goliath frog, which lives in Africa, and they're big enough to eat birds' eggs up in trees. Wow. And so these large frogs, like the Goliath frog and various bullfrog species that live around the world, they're in a lot of trouble because people like to eat them because they have large legs, and humans have a way of eating just about any animal that's large enough to eat. So frogs are definitely being hunted to near extinction in certain places. So we have several campaigns related to frog legs. As I said before, we've had protests in the past at restaurants that continue to serve frog legs. And we have a campaign in northern Ghana in West Africa. If you go out to some of those markets there, there will be just piles of frogs that they're selling. So out there, we have university chapters in Ghana, and the students go out and educate the communities about the problems with frog meat. And here in America, we also work on the frog leg issue. In California, especially, one of our biggest political campaigns right now is getting the state of California to ban the importation of American bullfrogs. The American bullfrogs are native to the eastern half of the United States, and they're America's largest frog. And so they have very large legs. So in recent decades, they've become the number one frog that's farmed for food around the world. The frog farms are proliferating, perhaps because they're a cheap meat. It's inexpensive to raise them, so they're growing them at farms around the world, and then they're shipping them to America. And the frog farms are not very hygienic places. The frogs are just piled on top of each other. When they get to America, they'll be sold in buckets of live bullfrogs crawling all over each other. And frogs are being affected by a chytrid fungus that's causing amphibians around the world. So this chytrid fungus causes skin disease. So when all these bullfrogs are crawling all over each other, it's perfect conditions to spread disease. California is importing about 3 million American bullfrogs into the state each year. And we're working to get that stopped as soon as possible. We've already gotten laws in place in the city and county of Santa Cruz. And anyone out there who wants to help, we have a webpage at savethefrogs.com/bullfrogs. We have a petition people can send. It's to Governor Jerry Brown, and that's at savethefrogs.com/bullfrog-petition. So we definitely encourage people to go sign the petition to get the bullfrogs banned.
Yeah, and the ban, is it not just because of how they're brought up, but can they escape in our environment in California and change that environment and also threaten other native species?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. Beginning at the frog farm somewhere overseas, they can escape and they're not native there, so they'll cause problems in those countries. And then they get shipped to America, and they'll either escape, or sometimes people set them free on purpose because they don't know any better, or possibly just the water that they're being held in gets flushed out into the environment, and there goes that chytrid fungus, which has caused the extinction of about 100 amphibian species.
Wow.
So their diseases cause trouble, and then when the bullfrogs get in the loose, they establish populations, and because they're such a large, they have a very large mouth, and they eat native frog species. They eat salamanders, snakes, birds, bats. So they're voracious predators of California's native wildlife.
Wow. We're listening to Kerry Krieger of Save the Frogs, and they're little quiet little things. You hear them on some nights, riveting, but they are deeply threatened. I know There's been some serious fines a couple of years back down near San Francisco Airport because people disturbed, I think, the red-legged frog's habitat. How's that being policed and monitored when they are endangered?
Well, I'm not sure about the San Francisco incident you referred to, but the California red-legged frog is a federally protected species. And that's one of the frogs that's threatened by the bullfrogs. The bullfrogs eat the red-legged frogs. And the red-legged frogs do have a lot of problems in San Francisco at Sharp Park, which is a coastal wetland. And the city of San Francisco operates a golf course on top of the wetland. And the city's been draining the wetlands and illegally killing endangered red-legged frogs. They have a pump that pumps the water from the wetland straight out to sea. And the pump house is actually precisely located on the pond where the California red-legged frog tadpoles are swimming around. So those tadpoles, in all likelihood, just get sucked out to sea. And then when the wetlands go down, the egg masses actually get caught on land, dry up. So red-legged frogs have so many problems in Santa Cruz County, where there's lots of agriculture. There's red-legged frogs, but there's a huge amount of pesticides that get sprayed on their habitat. And amphibians, because they live in the water, they're being exposed to the pesticides. And amphibians have permeable skin, so the pesticides are being absorbed right up into their bodies. So that's one of the problems that frogs face. There are so many different threats all happening to them at once. They'll have habitat destruction, pesticide, maybe people trying to eat them. Right. In some species, and that all contributes to stress. And right. The stress may make amphibians more susceptible to various diseases.
Sort of sounds like the bee colony collapse, doesn't it, where there's just a piling up of things that are affecting them.
Yeah, and all of a sudden everything starts disappearing. So the frogs are bioindicators. It's that they're telling us something's wrong in the environment and needs to be fixed. So at this point, it's not as if it's a surprise when animals are going extinct. That's why humans need to heed the signal and start taking decisive action.
Right. Now, but where are amphibians' place in the life chain, the food chain? What would happen, what is happening because of their reduction and disappearance?
Amphibians eat mosquitoes and flies and ticks and various pest species that spread diseases to humans. So they're definitely doing us a favor in that regard. And then they're also food for birds, fish, monkeys, even dragonflies and beetles will eat amphibian tadpoles and eggs. So they're very critical in the food web because they're right in the middle of things. And tadpoles also filter algae. They're eating algae in the water, so they're keeping the water supply clean. We depend on fresh, clean water. So when the amphibians disappear, other animal species can have trouble. It can change the food web in the streams and cause streams to clog up with various different algae and things that wouldn't be there and that shouldn't be there. So there's a whole lot of reasons to save the frogs, one of which is they're keeping our ecosystems healthy because everything on Earth or in most places has evolved to have frogs living there. For hundreds of millions of years, amphibians have been on Earth, and if they all of a sudden disappear, then something will undoubtedly be affected by it.
Well, this is it. Yeah, I'm just looking at what they've been around for about 250 million years. So they've seen a lot of other species come and go over those millennia. But, you know, what are we talking about in terms of the collapse? I mean, from 100%, are we, you know, like the redwoods, they're only 5% left of what there used to be. Is there any way of knowing where we're at right now in this window?
Yeah, it's about one-third of amphibian species are threatened with extinction. That means that those species are in so much trouble that if we don't do anything to fix the threats that they face, then we expect them to go extinct in the near future. And it's thought that well over 40% of species have populations that are declining in numbers. There's only about 2% of amphibian species that are thought to be increasing in numbers. And up to 200 species have gotten completely extinct in the last few decades. And to put that number in perspective, from the fossil record, the best we can tell is that amphibians naturally go extinct at about a rate of one species every 500 years. So we've lost almost 200 in the last 30 years. So they're disappearing several thousand times faster than they should be.
Wow. That's that ain't a good sign.
It's not.
And obviously it's accelerating, and they keep denying that it's us humans. That's the funny thing.
That's the problem, because the human population continues to grow. That means that not only do we have to fix the threats we currently face, we have to make sure that, you know, that the threats don't increase just because there's more people on the planet and more demand for natural resources. So, but fortunately, we understand most of the causes of amphibian extinctions, and because we understand the causes, we are on the path to being able to fix the problem. We just need to get the word out and get people living more ecologically friendly lives and living in ways that don't harm the amphibians. And then we need politicians to step up and take action for wildlife. And we need businesses and corporations to be a bit more ecologically friendly and not so concerned about their monetary intake, which of course is important, but if what the business is doing is destroying the planet, then that's a change that needs to be made.
Indeed. And now, how open are, say, government and businesses and scientists generally to what you're putting out there? I mean, do they say, yes, we understand it's a problem, but then give you lip service? Are people coming forward? What's happening in that response at that level?
I guess it all depends. There's some companies that don't want to hear anything because they don't want any additional regulation or they don't want to have to change. And there's some, plenty of companies that donate to environmental causes and give lots of support to environmental work. And there's politicians like in Santa Cruz, as I said, we got laws passed to ban bullfrogs. And, of course, Santa Cruz is more environmentally friendly than most places.
Right.
But, you know, that's a good sign. And it all depends. Most politicians, if I had to generalize, I'd say that they're open to hearing about problems. But usually what they say is, we got a lot of other stuff going on. So this isn't necessarily a priority for me to deal with, as far as, say, getting legislation in. Or if you look at the EPA, and they're supposed to be regulating harmful pesticides, you know, they clearly understand the problem, and they say they want to help. What do they do? Not much, from my experience.
Well, that's it. I mean, are you getting scientific, you know, legitimate scientific backing? I mean, is that the problem? It's hard to move them because they're in the control of some of those chemical companies that make the stuff that you want to get rid of?
All the science related to amphibian extinctions is incredibly clear. So there's no disputing what the causes of amphibian extinctions are. And some of these pesticides, like the one that we're focused on, atrazine, which is the number one herbicide used on corn, which is our number one crop in America. Atrazine, there's so much scientific literature demonstrating harmful effects to a wide array of wildlife and humans. And when I was at EPA about a month ago talking to them, they said, I asked them, why has atrazine been banned in Europe, in the European Union, but not in America? And they said, well, in the European Union, all you have to do is demonstrate that the atrazine is contaminating the water supply, which it is. And in America, you also need to show that it's got harmful effects. And so that kind of blew my mind, because there's so many papers saying the craziest things that atrazine does, such as causing hermaphroditism in frogs, complete sex reversal, related to prostate cancer in humans, and the list goes on. So it's crazy that our government allows these horrible pesticides to be sprayed on our food and that contaminate our water supply. Atrazine, the U.S. Department of Agriculture actually detected it in 94% of American tap water samples.
Wow. Whew, that is incredible. Whew. But, you know, in these situations, often, you know, hope comes in kids. I know you're, can you tell us about some of the programs that you're doing around the world and how you're getting to kids and trying to get the word out, you know, to start from the bottom up in a way?
Yeah, we do work a lot with kids. And I think it's incredibly important to have kids educated about the environment. When I was growing up, I received almost no education related to the environment or to frogs. And that's one of the reasons I started Save the Frogs. People would always ask me, why frogs? Why are frogs important? Why do you care about frogs? And I realized most people don't know that frogs are important or that they're disappearing. And we've made a lot of progress educating people. And that's what it, you know, we need a society that's educated. So if we start with kids, then we'll have a lot more people going into environmental careers, dedicating their lives to protecting the environment. We'll have a society that respects and appreciates nature and wildlife and lives in a more ecologically friendly manner. And if all kids grow up with respect for the environment, then, say, 20 years from now, getting environmental legislation will be a lot easier. Having more environmentally friendly companies is a whole lot more likely. So we do a lot of things for kids. We've got on our website, SaveTheFrogs.com, we have a page dedicated to students, one dedicated to teachers, lots of ways they can get involved. We have a Save the Frogs art contest and a Save the Frogs poetry contest. And one of the reasons I started these and that we continue to hold these contests is because a lot of teachers may not have biological experience, but they, by having their students get involved in these contests, it's a really easy way for someone without much background in frogs to send their students to our website, have them learn something about frogs, and then do something that shows what they learned. So we get a lot of art that clearly we can see in it, or the poetry you can read in it, that these kids have definitely learned a lot about frogs and frog conservation. So we just announced the winners for these contests, and we had about 1,000 poems from 50 different countries this year, and we had about 3,000 pieces of art from maybe 45 countries, which I thought was great, too, how else would we get our information into, say, a school in India? So we'll get schools in India that send us photos of 75 kids holding up their piece of frog art. So I think that's pretty neat. And we also give a lot of presentations in schools. I've spoken to thousands of students about frogs, and we're really to be opening Save the Frogs Education Center in Berkeley, California. And so we just moved from Santa Cruz to Berkeley, and we'll be opening up the education center, we hope, in February, and we're actually seeking donations. It's the first time we've ever had a public space. If anyone out there can contribute, it would be great. You can go to SaveTheFrogs.com/donate, and we're a 501c3 IRS-approved public charity, so it's tax-deductible. The education center is going to be a whole lot of frog education about our campaigns, about ways people can help, and we'll have regular presentations and conferences and workshops and classes in there. We'll have events for kids, and it'll be a great way to involve the community. And actually, Friday, December 13th, we're having an open house there, located in a complex with a lot of other nonprofits. So all the nonprofits are opening their doors to the public so that people can learn about all the great things that we all do.
Where's that going to be at, the address of that?
That's The Saved Frogs Education Center is at 2524 San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley, right on Main Street in Berkeley.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go to savethefrogs.com/events, our event page, it's got all the information up there. And anyone, if you have any questions, our email address is contact@savethefrogs.com.
Yeah, and we're speaking with Kerry Krieger of SaveTheFrogs.com, and he has made it his life's work. Who knew, eh, when you were starting out that this would happen, that what an amazing thing our lives take sometimes without realizing. And
That's right. I've been saving frogs for about 10 years now.
Do you have a favorite frog?
And my favorite frog is the southern orange-eyed tree frog from Australia. I did a lot of my PhD research on that frog. I spent a lot of time out in the rainforest, often in the pouring rain, at the edges of waterfalls, watching these frogs. They've got really incredible orange eyes and a really cool call, and they're just a really amazing animal to watch. And then another frog that I really like are the glass frogs, which live in Central and South America, and they're called glass frogs because they're kind of translucent. You can see through their skin, so if they have eggs in there, you can see the eggs inside them. You can kind of see their heart, and they tend to live right on the rainforest streams, too. As I said before, I really like being out at streams. But, you know, in general, anytime I hear a frog, I get pretty excited.
How old do frogs live? You know, is there a range, obviously, different types, but is there an average?
Yeah, there's some that probably only live 5 years or so, but there are frogs in New Zealand. The Archie's frog is known to live for about 36 years or so.
Wow.
So some of these frogs get really old. Bullfrogs and tailed frogs, they can live as tadpoles for multiple years. So tailed frogs
as
may
tadpoles.
Be a
tadpole. Oh, really?
They may be several years in the water just as a tadpole, waiting for conditions to be metamorphosed. So you can imagine if they're a tadpole that long, they're living a pretty long life in all likelihood.
Yeah, because I had a flame-bellied newt as a pet for, like, I think it was almost 20 years old. It was incredible.
Yeah.
It was, I couldn't believe it. And but now frogs, they are fairly important. Actually, there is actually a lot of research on what they have in them, isn't there? Can you tell us about? I know there are all sorts of varieties, and they have all sorts of weird chemicals that they produce. So, can you tell us something about that?
Sure. Frogs have lots of chemicals, especially on their skin, to protect them. They have antimicrobial peptides on their skin. So they've got this huge array of chemicals, and humans have done research on these chemicals and found things like natural mosquito repellents. There are chemicals on their skin that kill HIV.
Wow.
And so amphibians are really important in medicine. About 10% of the Nobel Prizes in physiology and medicine has gone to researchers whose work depended on amphibians. The first several decades was done almost exclusively on amphibians. In Australia, there were two frog species, the gastric brooding frogs, and these were the only species known where the mother would actually follow her young and shut off her gastric juices in her stomach and let them develop in her stomach and then spit them out. And it was thought that this frog would lead to a cure for ulcers, but both those frogs went completely extinct within about a year or two of being discovered by humans.
Oh, my goodness, that quick. Whoa, they were so rare to begin with. Huh.
Yes, and so every time we lose an amphibian species, there goes, you know, any potential to benefit humans from having that species around. You know, amphibians, they can regenerate limbs, and they can do all kinds of things that we can't do. As long as they're alive, we have plenty to learn from them.
Exactly, and as long as they're alive is the salient point, isn't it?
Yeah. And
before I forget,
let me say one thing that would be really important if people could do it. We're involved in a contest right now called the Sungevity Gives Back Contest, and the solar panel company Sungevity is offering $20,000 to the nonprofit that gets the most votes in this contest, and we're in a heated race for number one. And if people could go to the SaveTheFrogs.com website, right at the top of our homepage, the link to vote, and it'd be great if people could vote. And the voting goes through December 11th.
So people can help just remotely. That is great.
Yeah. I mean, definitely go to SaveTheFrogs.com and vote. But also we do have a How to Help page right at the top of our homepage. You'll see the link. We've got at least 50 ways on there for people to help. And those could be things like improving their ecological footprint or ways to get involved with Save the Frogs, things that people can do to volunteer. There's lots of ways to get involved.
A thought just came into my mind. You know, when I went to school, you know, we used to dissect frogs. Is that still done?
Yeah, it sure is. Probably hundreds of thousands of frogs getting dissected. I say probably because we really don't know, because the government does not seem to keep any records of how many frogs are being dissected or what species there are. But we know that one biological supply company took 300,000 frogs out of the wild in Mexico one year. And I would guess that at least 10% of Americans dissect frogs, and it's a lot of frogs. And most teachers are completely unaware of the origins of their frogs. They just assume that because they're ordering it from a biological supply company that everything must be okay. But that's definitely not the case. Traditionally, most frogs being dissected in America are northern leopard frogs, which in general are not easily raised in captivity. So those frogs are being taken out of the wild, and their populations have declined. And in other countries, it's normal for teachers to tell their students, tomorrow we're dissecting a frog, so go catch a frog and bring him into class.
Oh, really? Oh, so... Oh, my goodness. So they can be decimating it in that way.
Yeah. And, you know, what are we actually teaching kids? You know, we're not teaching them to respect nature.
Right.
So what's the actual lesson that they're getting? And how important is it for them to know what the inside of a frog looks like? Certainly when they're in fourth grade, and we have had reports of students in fourth grade dissecting frogs.
Yeah, I think 11 or 12, I think, I seem to remember when we did it. But,
And I personally never dissected a frog, so I know it's not something that's critical to a biologist's life, because I've done quite well in the world of frogs, and I didn't even have to dissect a frog to learn what I know now. I think it's far more important that given there's so much to learn and that teachers don't have enough time to teach your students everything, why not be teaching the students an hour's worth of frog conservation or environmental conservation, an hour of what the inside of a frog looks like, something that is not applicable to anyone's life.
Yeah, it's not as everyone's going to become a surgeon or something after.
Certainly not. And if they are, they can learn all about it when they go to med school.
Exactly. Oh dear. So yeah, I mean, you bring hope, but there's despair in the message, isn't there? Are we losing? You know, I know a lot of things where, you know, it's a matter of two steps forward, four steps back. How much energy has to be put in it to really reverse it?
Yeah, it's hard to say that. As I said, I think we know how to save the frogs. We just need a significant greater number of people helping out, and we need financial resources. We need companies donating, and we need a huge increase in corporate philanthropy. And people out there in the world should be donating to the environment. If you think about it, people pay, you know, say 20 to 30 or whatever percent of their money going to taxes to the government.
Right.
Well, the earth needs some assistance every year too. So if people want a healthy planet to live on, and if they want to leave a beautiful place with wildlife to their children, then they should be helping out the environment in one way or another, whether that's by volunteering for environmental nonprofits or by donating.
Indeed. And, let everyone know, again, how to contact you and how to donate and help out with Save the Frogs.
Okay, yes. Yeah, SaveTheFrogs.com is our website, and you can donate at SaveTheFrogs.com/donate. We have a lot of eco-friendly merchandise, like organic cotton T-shirts and things like that that make great gifts. So go check out our gift center. And you can email us contact@SaveTheFrogs.com. You can call us at 1-877-75-FROGS. And I definitely hope that you will go to SaveTheFrogs.com, right to the top of that page, and click the link to vote for Save the Frogs and help us win this $20,000 contest that's going on.
And is that the one that finishes on December 13th?
December 11th is the last.
Oh, December 11th. And December 13th, what was the event then?
Oh, December 13th is our open house at
the brand new
Save the Frogs Education Center at 2524 San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley, California. And this will be the very first time that we've opened the doors to the public.
Oh, wonderful. There'll be a lot of people hopping through, I hope.
I hope so. And you're invited.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for helping us spread frog awareness to everybody.
Oh, it is a pleasure, and we'll keep in contact, and we'll see what's happening. They are vital to our survival, so thank you so much for doing this great work and keeping us aware of this.
Thanks, Arnold. Save the frog.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Kerry. See you.